welcome to a special episode of Amplify. Today's episode is an update to the COVID-19 episode released earlier in the month. In fact, today we're bringing you a one-on-one interview with Dr. Andrea Duca, who is an emergency physician working in Milan. He completed his training in 2016 and had the opportunity to do a portion of his emergency medicine residency at Mount Sinai here in the United States. And the reason we're interviewing him is because of his unique experience as an emergency physician on the front lines in the middle of this epidemic in Italy. We covered a lot of topics in this interview, and they're all very relevant to our practice in emergency medicine here in the United States. But before you take a listen, take a deep breath, make sure you've got some time to spend with this audio, and that you're not stressed before you begin. It's a very, very stressful scenario in Italy right now. And if you're home or around your children and this audio is accessible to them, this may not be the best segment or episode to let them hear. And so without any further delay, here's Dr. Duca.
Okay, my name is Andrea Duca, and I'm an emergency physician. I live in Milan, Italy, and I work in Ospedale Papa Giovanni XXIII in Bergamo. I got specialized in 2015. And during my residency, I spent 4 months at Mount Sinai, thanks to Dr. Jagoda. I think that was one of the most useful experiences that I got during my residency.
All right. So let's start with, thinking back to when the epidemic finally hit Italy, and you were in the early stages. Can you remember what your typical shifts were like and how many cases were coming in and how you were identifying those in the beginning as opposed to where you are now?
Yeah, I remember it well because in the beginning, we saw just a few patients coming back from China having met people coming back from China, but they were just a few. We screened them in the triage area. And if anyone was coming from China with fevers or respiratory symptoms, they were sent to the isolation room and then evaluated there. But it was just a few patients. And then I remember I went to do night shift and I had fevers. I had cough and fevers.
You did?
I did.
Okay.
But I had to work that night. And coming back in the morning, I listened to the radio saying COVID is in Italy. There is a COVID case in Italy. And I thought, I'm lucky that it's pretty far from here. It was about 50 kilometers from Milan. So it looked like it was one patient who met another guy coming back from China. So it looked as something isolated. Mm-hmm. The problem was that in the next days, we discovered that COVID was already in Italy since many days. So we found a lot of new cases. And in the next days, more and more people started to come to the emergency department, even though they had only mild symptoms, like upper airway symptoms or some fevers. So we just had to screen them to ask them if they had any trip to China or to Codogno, which is the first city involved. We were not afraid at that point.
When you were coming across these patients, were you testing them or just screening them by vital signs, you know, fever and travel history?
Well, we tested only the patients coming from China or from Codogno area at that time.
And those tests were available in hospital, or you had to send them to a government lab of some sort?
We had to send them away, yeah, at the time. We had to send them to one hospital in Milan and one hospital in Rome to have a confirmation of the test. We really admitted just a few patients in that days. The problem came around the 27th or 28th of February, where a lot of patients started to come with lower respiratory symptoms and fevers. So we had to start to admit more and more patients. And the week after, I think about like in the first days of March, the number of patients with lower respiratory symptoms rised up. So by now we are admitting about 80% of the patients coming to our emergency department because of bilateral pneumonia.
Ah, so I was going to ask, now when you say lower respiratory symptoms, you mean so pneumonia, hypoxia, some respiratory distress, those kinds of things?
Exactly. By now, 80% of the patients coming to the emergency department are hypoxic on room air, so they need some form of oxygen. And within these patients, about 30% need some form of ventilatory support.
Wow.
So the numbers are huge.
And what percentage of your daily volume is COVID patients, as opposed to, you know, chest pain and abdominal pain, appendicitis, routine things?
Luckily, clean patients decreased a lot because a patient without severe symptoms are not coming anymore to the emergency department. And there was a change of organization of the stroke network, the STEMI network, and the trauma network in our region. So we are one of the trauma center of the level one trauma center of Lombardy, and the only pediatric trauma center of Lombardy. But in this time, trauma patients are not coming anymore to our hospital. Stroke patients are not coming to our hospital. They are sent to other hospitals within Lombardy. So by now, I have to say that COVID flow is about 90% of what we do in the ED.
And are the COVID patients being preferentially sent to your facility if we know that they're febrile or shortness or have shortness of breath or other symptoms that might be suspicious for COVID? Are you the receiving facility for that population?
Probably it started like that. But by now, all of the hospitals around Bergamo are full of COVID positive patients. They decided to have one hospital admitting all the COVID patients, which is in Seriate near Bergamo. But I think it was enough just for 1 or 2 days. By now, we have about 480 patients admitted for COVID in our hospital.
Wow. And do you still test people for COVID, or do you just assume they have it?
We do test only the people that we are admitting to the hospital. But by now, I think it's just for epidemiological reasons, because they all have the same clinical pattern. So I do not need the test to understand that that patient is COVID positive. They all have bilateral pneumonia. They're hypoxic, hypocapnic, with LVH elevated. So they're all, they really are all the same.
And when you get those patients, as far as treatment goes, besides respiratory and ventilatory support, are you using anything else? Do you still prophylax with antibiotics for pneumonia, or are you just assuming this is COVID and there is no treatment?
No, we start antibiotic on almost all of these patients while evaluating them and while starting the test. And if they have a severe respiratory failure, we start hydroxychloroquine and antivirals.
Which antiviral are you using now? Do you know?
It depends on what we have. We started with lopinavir. And then we moved to, I don't remember the name right now. It's like darunavir.
And so this is kind of the routine. They get antibiotic, they get antiviral, and they get hydroxychloroquine?
Antiviral and hydroxychloroquine only if they are in severe respiratory failure. In that case, we start this therapy waiting for the results of the test.
And what about ventilatory support? So there's been a lot of discussion, at least on the state side, with non-invasive ventilatory support, intubation, protecting the staff, perhaps preferring intubation over the non-invasive modalities. Is that even a thought for you?
We do not have the resource to intubate all of these patients. You have to imagine to have like 20 patients every day coming in a respiratory distress and needing an ICU bed for at least 10 days each patient. So we start all of them on non-invasive ventilation, mostly on helmet CPAP. And I have to say that it works very well in most of the patients. To temporize, to get some time to find an ICU bed. I'll say that mild and moderate ARDS do well with helmet CPAP, at least for the first days, while severe ARDS obviously are not going so well. But it helps to buy some time to get an ICU bed. And speaking about the aerosolization of the virus, we do put viral filters before the PEEP valve on the helmets so that the virus is not spreading around. And the same for non-invasive ventilation. We use viral filters attached to the masks of patients. And since the leaks are very low with oronasal masks, the spreading of the virus is really, really low. We always use, however, FFP2 masks, which I think it's the same as yours, N95 masks, when we approach these patients.
And are you maintaining them on the airborne category of isolation once they're on this ventilation support? When they go in hospital, are they on airborne isolation or droplet isolation, or is there a difference in your center?
Well, the problem is that in my emergency department, we only have one isolation room with negative pressure ventilation. So we used it for the first cases. By now, of course, we had more than 100 patients at a time inside the emergency department. So it would be impossible to isolate all of them. So we keep a dirt area of the emergency department that is now about 90% of the emergency department.
Wow.
We dress up before entering that area, and then we stay dressed up with this mask all day long, well, all shift long.
And as you go from one patient room to the next, is it just you're changing gloves, or do you have to change gown, or you just hand sanitize the gloves?
We do not have rooms. We have created a big non-invasive ventilation room with all the patients inside. I just change my gloves, and that's it. We don't have enough gowns to change ourselves many times a day, so we just change the gloves.
So when you dress to enter this area, you're wearing your, you call it an FFP mask, and then your gown, your gloves, anything else? Shoe covers or head cover or?
Everything. Shoe covers, head covers, and glasses.
And glasses. Okay. Yeah. And when you started all of this, I mean, presumably you didn't have a dirty area of your emergency department in the beginning as volume started to increase. And there was a delay in getting people out of the emergency department. You had to start holding or containing some of these people. Is that when you finally flipped the switch to create this dirty area or hot zone in your emergency department?
I think we created a dirty flow very early. So knowing that there was people coming back from China, we already created the dirty flow. Was using the isolation room. When numbers increased, we dedicated one room and one waiting room to the dirty flow, and then we increased the space taken by the dirty flow day by day until reaching 90% of the ED.
And the waiting room you mentioned, that's also segregated, so dirty and clean. As people are coming in, they're being screened to one waiting room or the other?
Now they are screened in the triage area where they arrived, and they are divided there in the clean and dirty area.
Just so people have a frame of reference, do you know the annual volume at your ER or even just the daily volumes?
It's about 100 patients, 100,000 patients per year. I think it takes into account everything. So OBGYN, ortho, peds, ophthalmology. If you take into account only adult patients, taking off all these OBGYN, ortho, I think it's about 60,000 patients per year. And by now, and we serve a population of about 1 million people. We are the biggest hospital there. And our hospital is about 880 beds hospital.
And how many spaces in the department, in the emergency department?
We have a lot of spaces. Fortunately, it's pretty new as a hospital. They built it up I think the first years of this of 2000. So it's pretty new. And we have a lot of spaces, and it's, by now we have about 80 COVID patients coming every day.
You said most of them, like 80 or 90%, are being admitted to the hospital?
Yeah, that's the problem.
And are all of them actually making it out of the ER by the end of the day, or you still have some that are holding?
No. I think on the first days of March, we have a ward, an acute medicine ward that is attached to the emergency department. We closed the ward in order to put there patients waiting for admission. So we created 21 beds for patients waiting for admission. But of course, they're never enough. We are transferring out many patients, trying to use nursing home residencies and rehabilitations for lower acuity patients. It's a continuous reorganization of the flows inside the emergency department, inside the hospital, and within the region.
And as you transfer them out of the hospital to these other locations, if they're less sick, they will take, obviously, COVID-infected patients. Do they Do they congregate, you know, like a convalescence home will take all COVID patients and they'll keep trying to keep them together?
Yeah, this is what is happening. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back now and talk about the staff. So you mentioned in the very early days you had a fever. Do you know, have you actually had the infection?
Well, actually, I got tested because it was just the early epidemic. I got tested, I was negative, and I came back to work. We now know that the sensitivity of the test is 60 to 70%. So I still think that I got COVID. However, last week I got fevers again. So I had to stay home, but we do not test us anymore now. For two reasons. The first one is that we cannot afford to stay home for 14 days in Bergamo. And the second reason is that I think we all got some mild symptoms in the last weeks, and we continued to go back to work. So it would be strange now to change things. We should test all of us, but we don't have enough resources to test all the sanitary personnel. So what we do is just to wait to get better, wait 7 days, and then go back to work.
And do you start the 7 days from the day the fever starts?
No. From the day you get you recover.
Ah, I see.
So you have to wait the fever to go away, wait 7 days, and then go back.
And then go back. Okay.
Our protocol would be to test before going back to work. But by now, we cannot afford it.
Yeah, because there's not enough staff left. I mean, yeah. you can't afford to have the staff not come back to work.
Exactly. Maybe things are changing because in these days, military doctors are coming to help in our hospital. So maybe things will change. But by now, this is the actual situation.
Throughout the last few weeks, what in your update that you helped us create for EB Medicine, you said count on about 10% of your staff being sick at any given point. Do you think that was the worst of it, is you had about 10% of your staff gone? Was it ever like 50% or something of that sort?
Well, this is the strange thing. The rate is very low in our emergency department, while inside the hospital, the rates are much higher. This is why I think that probably we got ill in the last weeks before the epidemic starts, and we didn't think it was COVID, so we continued to work. Because it's really strange that only 10% of us got ill since the start of the epidemic. While in other wards, they got like 40 to 50% rates. Wow. And they do not see COVID patients.
Wow.
So they got ill like outside the hospital probably, or inside the hospital with non-suspected patients.
And when the non-ED staff gets sick, you said up to 40% of them might be gone. Do they just shut down that much capacity in the hospital, or how are they handling that?
Well, by now, all the elective activity has been stopped in our hospital, in order to treat COVID patients. So they, like surgeons, do not operate anymore. They treat COVID patients as a fact.
Okay, so tell me more about that. These are surgeons like your general surgeons, thoracic surgeons, I mean, your orthopedic surgeons, they're helping treat COVID patients?
Yeah, sure. Inside the ward, not in the emergency department. We have only one internal medicine ward and one pneumologic ward. And of course, 480 patients are more than what they could have in that words. So we created a lot of new words and put any doctor to follow these patients. They started to do some courses on helmet CPAP, how to put it on, and how to follow these patients. And they follow all these patients in the world. We are doing helmet CPAP in almost all of the hospital.
Wow. But have you run out of helmet CPAP?
Not really, because my chief is an expert in non-invasive ventilation. So we had a lot of helmets. We had some problems in CPAP devices, like the device to generate the flow needing for helmet CPAP. But I don't know how he found a way to get a lot of them. So by now, I never had a problem treating a patient with helmet CPAP.
That's good. That's a blessing.
Yeah.
And when, so currently the flow for staff in the ER or outside the ER is if they get sick, they go home. And then 7 days after the fever is gone, they're allowed to return to work.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also in the updates you sent us, you mentioned something about ultrasound. So you're using that now in your protocols. Tell me how that fits into your examination of a patient.
Yeah. We use ultrasound a lot every day. In this epidemic, we had to change our way of using it because there's no time to do something useless. So I usually ultrasound every patient coming to the emergency department, but now I had to stop. And I think it's very useful in the patients that you want to send home, because for critically ill patients, I just give a look that they do not have pneumothorax. So I just look for contraindications to non-invasive ventilation, and then I started. I don't need to make the diagnosis with lung ultrasound because I know they have COVID infection as soon as I see them. I then use ultrasound to follow them to see if they develop pneumothorax and if I have time to stratify them and to understand if they will respond to CPAP or not. But I think it is most useful in the patients coming with fever and cough, with an oxygen saturation that is normal, and you want to send home. Because chest X-ray has a very low sensitivity. So if you do not want to CT scan all of these people, you can just ultrasound them. If ultrasound is negative, the probability of them to have COVID pneumonia is very low. So what we do is we see these patients, we do chest X-ray and labs, we do lung ultrasound. And then if everything is okay, we just have them walk with a pulse oximetry on their fingers and check. If they do not desaturate while walking, we send them home.
And what's their cutoff for desaturation while walking? 90%?
No, it's 3 points less than oxygen saturation on resting.
And if they're dyspneic while they're walking, but their oxygen saturation is okay, still home.
Yeah. By now, yeah. Well, of course, when the epidemic started, it was not like this. Like, I would have not sent anyone dyspneic while walking home. But by now, we keep only patients who desaturate.
So normal vitals, unremarkable labs, normal chest X-ray, pulmonary ultrasound that's normal, and then you ambulate them if their oxygen saturation does not drop by more than 3 points, then they can go home.
Yeah. If they have positive lung ultrasound or positive chest X-ray, but they do not desaturate, we are starting a protocol by which we give them a pulse oximetry device, and we send them home with it, and we teach them how to do a walk-in test every day and to look for the saturation, and in case of the saturation, to come back.
Have you run out of those devices? You have enough to give people?
You have to understand that we see 80 patients a day, and we send home about, I don't know, 10 patients a day by now. So we don't need so many devices. This is also because the EMS is not bringing to the emergency department people with a saturation, oxygen saturation over 90.
They're just leaving them at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the EMS is performing kind of a field screen in that scenario. If they're saying your saturation's above 90% and you're not in distress, you're going to stay home. We're not going to transport you to the hospital.
Exactly. Yeah.
And when you say the walking test, so how far do you have them walk? Is this
30 meters?
30 meters and just a normal rate. No brisk.
No. They have to walk as fast as they can without running.
Without running. Okay. I like it. So then you mentioned EMS. Now this is the screen that you're giving all patients, or is this the screen just for the elderly? And if they're younger, then or is this the screen for all comers?
It's for all patients.
All patients. Okay. And if they do drop their pulse oximetry when they're walking, then you're admitting them for observation and just oxygen therapy at that point. Minus anything else? Okay.
So, yeah.
And when you do your lung ultrasound, what are you looking for?
I'm looking mostly for B lines and small like pleural abnormalities. This is what I'm looking for in this kind of patients. While in severely ill patients, like patients with ARDS, I'm looking also for consolidation. Because we have seen that when you see consolidation early, they are less responsive to CPAP and non-invasive ventilation. While when you see an interstitial pattern, they usually do respond pretty well to PEEP.
And if you do see consolidation, are you going to just skip the non-invasive and try and find them a ventilator and intubate early, or you still go through that series of steps?
We cannot afford to intubate these patients. So we, unless they're about to die, we start them on non-invasive ventilation. Anyway, we try, because our lung ultrasound is not proven to be good to choose which patient is PEEP responsive. So we try anyway to give some PEEP, and then we decide.
So you're using it more as a tool to guide disposition, home or need to stay. And then once you know they need to stay, you're screening with ultrasound just to track their clinical progress. And there are some suggestions that if they're developing more focal infiltrates, that perhaps this patient is not going to do as well than the next person who just has interstitial changes on ultrasound.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is pneumothorax, because you can imagine that putting helmet CPAP with 20 centimeters of water of PEEP on hundreds of patients will lead to many pneumothorax. So you have to expect it, and to have devices to treat them in the emergency department, of course.
Are you using a lot of pigtail catheters and smaller tubes for those kinds of pneumothoraces?
If they need to be ventilated, they need bigger tubes.
How big are you using?
24, okay. At least.
Is that because the reaccumulation rate is too high for a small tube to handle?
Yeah, that's what we fear.
I see. So you have lots of patients in your area that have chest tubes and a CPAP mask and helmet.
Fortunately, people having chest tubes are just a few in our area. Maybe it happens in the world. By now, it happened to me just two times. And one time, we had to treat the patient, while the other time, he was at ceiling therapy with CPAP. We were deciding if stopping CPAP, and the pneumothorax made us stop it.
And when you stopped CPAP therapy, what then?
We gave him non-rebreather mask, morphine, and he died.
He died. Okay. So that was more of a withdrawal of care at that point.
Yeah, we were deciding about withdrawing CPAP. Mm-hmm. We probably would have continued it if he hadn't developed that pneumothorax. But it was something that told us that we couldn't go on.
And so, are you seeing patients with pneumothorax and CPAP on the wards as well? Or does the pneumothorax mean they have to now be in intensive care? Or are there even any spaces in intensive care? Is that just reserved for intubated patients?
ICU is reserved for intubated patients.
So all floor nurses really have to become comfortable with dealing with chest tubes and the non-invasive CPAP ventilation.
Yeah, that's it. It's a problem.
When we talk about the staff again, there's been a little bit of information about pregnancies and whether or not pregnancy puts you at higher risk or there's any risk to the fetus in that scenario. I don't know if you've had the chance to treat any pregnant patients or had any pregnant staff members. Any experience there?
Not real. Like, fortunately, we do not have any pregnant staff now working during the epidemic. And I haven't seen any pregnant patients. But I have to say that in our emergency department, pregnant patients are followed by OBGYN unless they are critically ill. So we didn't see any critically ill pregnant patients. Maybe there are many not critically ill.
What about children? Have you seen any critically ill pediatric cases?
No. It's the same. We see only critically ill children. Otherwise, they are seen by pediatricians. And I haven't seen any children during the epidemic.
Good. Do you know if your pediatric colleagues are still having to deal with an increase in the number of PEDS cases being admitted just for hypoxia, even if it's only temporary? Do you know any of that?
I know they had many cases, but I don't know the numbers.
When you test, you said you test patients who are being admitted. So is that test now occurring in-house or is it still sent to a government lab?
No, it's in-house now. It takes I think 8 to 10 hours.
And are you having to retest patients at any point? I mean, if their initial test is negative, do you even bother with another one?
That's the problem. Like, we do not bother because we admit them. We usually test again in 2 or 3 days if they are negative and we know that they have COVID.
One of the other things you mentioned was preparing some psychological support for your staff. What have you guys done in that arena that's been helpful?
We can have psychological support. We have a number we can call to organize a meeting. And they are there for us every day. I think it's important because you have to imagine that from one day to another, you cannot meet any people outside the hospital. because of the containment measures. So you only go from your home to the hospital and then go back to your home. And inside the hospital, you always wear masks and gowns. And you fight every day with a lot of people needing to be treated and suffering and waiting for admissions without enough beds. So the stress is very, very, very high.
Wow. Well, that's a very sobering thought, really. So the isolation there is actually making things even worse, because you're not only quarantined outside the hospital, but then even inside the hospital with masks and gowns and hot zones, you've got more isolation keeping you away from your colleagues even. And then you're just surrounded by massive demand with very few resources. That sounds like a very terrible scenario.
Yeah, it's hard. We have a lot of WhatsApp chats to help us, even though this is also a problem, because you get out of the hospital and you start to read and write messages on the phone, mm-hmm. and you continue to think about what is happening and to think what you can do better, what can be improved. That is very good for the system. But it's hard because you never stop thinking about these patients and about the epidemic.
Wow. Well, listen, our thoughts and prayers will be with you and your colleagues and all of you in the hospitals there. Fortunately, our level of epidemic has not reached the experience you've had yet. I think the hope is that some form of social isolation might try to reduce the number of patients coming to the hospital at any given time and hopefully stretch the outbreak here in the U.S. over a longer period of time and not exhaust the resources. But time will tell if that's successful. In the meantime, I'll ask one last question. Is there anything else you wish you knew at the start of this that you know now that you think you would have found helpful?
I would have liked to know that the rates of patients needing ventilation were so high. We were lucky because the epidemic here hit Lodi, which is a town near Milan, before Bergamo, just a few days before Bergamo. So they told us that a lot of patients needing ventilation would come. And we had some time to prepare, but it was not enough. Like if we knew, we would have changed all the organization of the health system in all of the region, like dedicating hospitals to see only COVID patients and hospitals to clean patients. This is what they are trying to do in Milan. And I think that preparedness is the key to manage the epidemic. Without having time to prepare, it's really hard. Because the numbers, we have never seen so many critically ill patients together. Like the other patients, I think, it's bad, but they can wait for a bed. We can find some oxygen for them. The problem is for critically ill patients that need the resources soon. So you have to prepare this kind of resources.
Wow. Well, thank you again.
You're welcome.
It really is quite sobering, and I really appreciate you being a resource for us.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. It's a sobering discussion about the Italian experience with COVID-19 and something that is likely to be in our future here in the U.S. in some form or another. Thanks again for listening in to this special episode of Amplify. I'm your host, Sam Eshoo. Until next time, stay safe.